Welcome to the podcast, where we challenge conventional thinking and explore fresh, forward-looking perspectives on leadership. Whether you're a seasoned executive or an aspiring leader, join us on a journey to uncover the complexities of modern leadership. Because leadership itself may not change, but the way we think about it is constantly evolving. This is Rethinking Leadership, a podcast by T. Yas Business School, hosted by Executive Professor Rumer Visser.
Today, my guest is Professor Dirk van Dierendonck, Professor of Leadership and Management down the road from us at TS at Rotterdam School of Management, where he's been working for 20 plus years. And Dirk, you have really identified or chosen servant leadership as sort of your area of scholarship and expertise. As you may recall, we're looking at this phenomenon that we call leadership from as many different angles as we can in this podcast. So I'm really looking forward to learning more about leadership from your perspective. Okay. Welcome to the program.
Well, great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Of course, of course. So maybe I can start with kind of a general question for the listener. And the listener I have in mind is somebody who may not have read the Robert Greenleaf book on servant leadership and may not have been sort of introduced to this this lens. So for that sort of general listener, what is servant leadership and what is it not?
Okay, that is a simple question with a broad answer normally. I think that you already said, talked about Robert Greenleaf. Robert Greenleaf basically, I would say, maybe coined the term in 1970 after working with AT&T for 40 years. So he retired and he basically put all his thinking, his knowledge about how companies work and how he saw that leadership worked within companies in a small booklet. And he called that kind of leadership, servant leadership. And an important element of what he emphasized in his leadership or in his leadership thinking was that you need, that you have a responsibility as a leader. And that that responsibility extends beyond shareholders. It's also important to include the people in your organization. The very important way of looking at leadership is relating to the people within your organization. But also things like other stakeholders, the influence that a company has on society and external, all these things are very important for Robert Greenleaf. So when I look at servant leadership nowadays and the way that it's being studied and also conceptualized, you see these elements come back. It is, in that sense, a leadership theory, a model, or a way of looking at leadership which emphasizes that the people and the needs of people is very important, so that you, when you build a company as a CEO, as a manager, that you look, that you do that with the people and that you see like, okay, what is it they need? And that if you take their needs first, that then they will take care of the customers and everything else.
Okay. So that seems to validate the way I've been, the way it's been explained to me, which is in sort of the conventional thinking about leadership, the leaders at the top of the pyramid influences down through a variety of means. And ultimately reports back to the shareholder. And this is a way of flipping the pyramid upside down, that your job as a servant leader is to serve those people, particularly those lower in the organization who have customer-facing roles.
Yes.
Is that fair to say?
I think that's very fair to say. And it is this flipping the organization pyramid is very important because what it means is that instead of being the one that tells what's going to happen, you're the one that creates the conditions for the people within the organizations to be the best they can and to basically grow as within their roles and just try, be creative, be innovative. All these things become important because it's no longer about you as the boss, but it's about them and how you, from your responsibility, can create that environment.
Yeah. Now, I imagine when that book was published in 1970, it would have been on the margins of leadership thought, to say the least.
Yes.
And that's my assumption. He wasn't a scholar. He wrote from his own experience, knowledge, as mm-hmm. I understand it, very much influenced by his own faith.
Yes.
Right? A very, in a way, you might say, radical break from the maybe even today still very dominant shareholder mm-hmm. value sort of paradigm.
Yes.
So he's saying, yes, shareholders matter, but mm-hmm. indirectly, but we need to focus our attention on meeting the needs of our people.
Yes.
I can imagine a work like that coming out in, I don't know, maybe in a country or a culture with a, let's say, a more collectivist or socialist mm-hmm. sort of tradition, maybe, you know, in Germany or the Netherlands. But it's interesting that it came out in the US at that time.
Yes.
What do you think explains, why do you think that happened there?
I think it happened there because it was different from the way that normally organizations were being run and still are being run for the majority.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a purely capitalistic way of viewing things, then shareholders are the most important person in that sense.
Yeah.
And the rest basically can be replaced. So you have your people become your resource.
Yeah.
If you look from a sort of leadership perspective, then they're no longer just a resource. Of course, it's important what they can bring and the competences, but you also look at them from a whole person perspective.
Yeah.
And that's different. So I think it came out in the US because of the need there. And you're right, when it came out, it did not have that much influence. It was basically a booklet that was mm-hmm. published somewhere. And the first, so basically companies picking it up, well, a lot of times companies were owned by one person. And he was reading it and says like, this is what I want to do. So he basically bought the book, gave it into his company and says, you know, this is what I want our company to do. This is how we do that. And then they sort of figured it out. There was no road plan, nothing. There was just the general ideas of a book from maybe 80, 90 pages. Mm-hmm. And then they read it and they discussed it and they started to change the way they did their business.
So it really kind of went viral, right, in a way.
Yes.
It did not sort of emerge from any of our usual suspects in terms of academic institutions, you know, leadership scholars that came from practice.
Yes.
And at what point did it become a more or less legitimate or valid sort of leadership theory? At what point did it get picked up by academia?
I think it started by the end of around 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Around 2000, you see the first PhD thesis, which was written by Jim Laub, and he developed a measure, and that was the first effort, the real serious effort, to do an academic kind of work with it and to use it. And then slowly but surely, you see others in like in Australia, San Sanjaya, or Bob Lydon from Chicago, Illinois, and they were like also very much interested, intrigued by it, and they started to develop their measures. Also here in Rotterdam, together with one of my PhD students, Inge Nuyten, we also developed the measures. So between mm-hmm. 2000 and 2010, sort of say, different people at different places at world says, they were intrigued by their thinking. And what you do if you're in a quantitative like leadership scholars, as we all are, we then sort of like, okay, if we want to study that, we need a measure.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of measures out there, and there still are. I think presently we may have like 15 or 16 different measures.
And when you say measure, are you talking about a self-report question?
Yes, a self-report kind of question.
Yeah.
No, not self-report, it's other report. So we ask the people in the organization to rate their direct reports or direct leadership, their direct supervisor.
Yeah.
Okay. So that is what most of the measures are. And it's also very important because sometimes I get questions that's like, can we use this as a self-report? And yes, you can. But what I've seen is that it's very difficult for us as people in a leadership position to judge how we come across.
Yeah.
And there's a big difference between what we think we do or how we do that and our motivation and how it comes across to the people around it. And especially with servant leadership, it's very hard. So you need that perspective of the other person to see like, okay, this is what I meant to do, but this is what the people see that I'm doing. Wait a minute, how do I bring that together?
Yeah. So I know you teach leadership courses, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. I do as well. I remember somebody who said, you know, I am a servant leader, which I thought was a very telling thing to say, right? There's an identification with this theory. This is who I am.
Yes.
I am a servant leader. Putting aside what we just talked about, which basically is, you know, you don't get to decide that.
No.
The people around you get to, you have no say. But assuming that you do have a say, because of course we know what the intent is behind it. What would you say to that person?
What would I say? Maybe first of all, I would say what we just talked about. It's very difficult for you to really judge it. But the other is I would welcome it. And then you can always have a conversation and say like, okay, how can you make it happen? Because now we are, you know, we have done 25 years of research in academia. We do have some ideas about how you can come across more as a servant leadership than we knew before. So there are definitely pointers you can give to that person to become more of a servant leader.
Yeah. Yeah. I know this is a bit of a language game, a little bit of a nuance, but is it about becoming more of a servant leader, which could be a little bit more of that stronger identification? Or is it really about building a skill set in that area while not neglecting a skill set in that other area? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
My thought, when somebody says, I am a servant leader, my first thought is, well, good luck. Good luck with that. Good luck in those situations where something else is required.
What is interesting, by the way, if you look at companies in the US mainly at the moment that work with servant leadership principles, they also work with accountability. So that is very important to realize that servant leadership doesn't mean that performance is not important. It's not like that we let free run and you can do whatever there is. It's also be clear about what is it that's expected and how we achieve it. It's just that when we talk about what it is and how to do it, you do that together with the people.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. That's the big difference that you have.
That's a really important nuance to make.
Yes.
Because we're so what you're saying is we're not necessarily in the business of coddling people.
No.
We hear conversations like that in the context of psychological safety as well. Mm-hmm. Psychological safety has become the golden standard, and it means, you know, make it safe for people, therefore don't hold them accountable. Don't light a fire. And so I just really want to emphasize the same holds true here in servant leadership. We still have to deliver results.
You still have to do that. And I think that's very important also in the measure that we developed here in Rotterdam to really, we make that an essential element of the way that we look at servant leadership. Also in the models that are out there, I find it important to realize that servant leadership is still about leadership. So it's still about providing direction. It's still about thinking, where are we going, responsibility that we are. You just do it in a different way.
Yeah.
And that's make a huge difference. Just simply doing, and it makes also very difficult because I think it's thinking like, okay, I want to be a servant leader. And when I talk about it in the courses, what I do, I never say, I expect you to be all servant leadership. Leaders. What I do say is that within servant leadership theory, there are characteristics, there are a way of looking at leadership that maybe can help you, that you become a better leader. Because for me, that is what leadership development is about. It's not about replacing one thing with the other, but becoming broader in what you can do, what you want to do, so that you can sort of like target it to what is needed given the circumstances of where your company, your organization is.
Got it. And if you look at, maybe we can look under the hood just a little bit more, because we've sketched servant leadership and contrasted it with transformational. You mentioned there's a questionnaire that you have, a measure. And I'm curious, can you give an example of one or two questions that have a very strong sort of, I guess, content validity to servant leadership, and maybe one or two questions that are really good indicators of transformative leadership. So what are you looking for in those questionnaires that would indicate either?
Well, if I go a little bit away from the items itself, that I wouldn't know by heart, but okay. I would say an important working mechanism in the servant leadership and a measure is empowerment. And then really to coach people, to give people autonomy and see that as a sort of working agency. There is more to it. It's also about being authentic. It's also about, you know, a sense of humility. All these things are important, but an important driving element is, can you empower people to allow them to do the best that they can do and trust them that they do have it in them? I think that what transformational leadership has also this element of trying to get people to do more, to do better. But the big difference is that then leaders probably think more about the vision for the company. So it's about, okay, how can I sort of like motivate people to stand behind the vision that we have of this company?
Yeah.
So having a good vision. And so that's also why transformational leadership is also more towards the visionary kind of aspects to have that out there. So yeah. That would be, and again, we're making something bigger difference where actually in reality, they're very much closer together.
I think. That's also a really important thing to emphasize. So if you're really, let's say, developed or skilled as a servant leader, you already have an important part of the package for becoming a better transformative leader as well.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, because people like me tend to make that distinction as if they are mutually exclusive just to create that contrast. So
yes,
thank you for saying that. That's really useful.
Yeah.
I think you answered the question already implicitly, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So obviously, you know, the first place to look is, am I meeting the needs of my people in pursuit of the company goals or the organizational goals? If those needs at some point conflict, we have an employee need over here, but we also have, you know, our accountability conversation. I can imagine that you start to maybe get confused about, well, who or what am I supposed to serve here? Mm-hmm. If I serve my team, my employee, I'm going to make one decision. But if I serve the broader interest, the organizational needs, whatever, I'm going to make another decision.
Yes.
Does servant leadership give any guidance when faced with that dilemma?
The challenge, I think, if you really want to practice servant leadership, is to have this end kind of way of doing things.
Ah.
So to work with two aspects which seem to be opposites. So that is also why you see that we think like cognitive complexity is important.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to basically hold two things which are opposites in your mind at the same time and then see if you can find a solution to move it forward. Because the tendency that we have is to go to either one or the other.
Yep.
It takes a little bit of an effort and a sort of standing back to say like, wait a minute, what can I do to maybe reach both? And I think it also helps a lot that if somebody doesn't fit with the direction a company is going, that you not just say, like, you're fired, but have a conversation and see, like, hey, what is happening? And you give us, usually, from a servant leadership perspective, you give people an opportunity. You say, like, we can grow here, or we can do this or that. So it's less black and white, but more a conversation you have with that person. And if that person needs to sort of like find somewhere else, to have everything you can do as a good employer to help them find another job somewhere else. Because yes, it can happen. I mean, organizations change, companies change, the market changes. So sometimes people fit less than not, but you can still treat people with respect.
Yes, okay. I hear you. You're saying don't fall in the trap of the easy sort of either or decision making. There are ways to honor both.
Usually there are.
Usually.
You just have to look for them consciously.
To look for ways to do
it.
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned earlier also the contrast, again, to maintaining this sense of contrast. Transformative leadership or transformational leadership is about realizing the broader vision and mobilizing resources to achieve that.
Yes.
And the one for servant leadership is really about empowerment. Empowerment was a word you used a couple of times.
Yes.
Is servant leadership then a proxy for employee engagement?
Well, employee engagement can happen in different ways.
Okay.
So you can have very engaged people, and why they do it can be leadership. It can also be people can be very engaged because they have the perfect team that they work for, even irrespectful of the organization. They can have a great organization. If you have a good organization structure, a great HR system, you need less of the leadership. So yeah. I think engagement is a broader context, and that can be sort of influenced by different factors.
Okay.
So I would not
pick
them one-on-one.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Okay. When I reflect on what you've said so far in terms of the why of servant mm-hmm. leadership, mm-hmm. There seems to be a bit of a moral foundation to it. You know, you can treat people with respect. You don't have mm-hmm. to. And by the way, I fully agree with that. So mm-hmm. I'm not challenging that. But I'm wondering if on top of that, if there's also any additional evidence for its relevance in terms of conventional business results.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Can you give some examples?
Well, there are different studies which basically look at whether how sales are going or how the financial results are going. And in all of them, servant leadership works very well.
Okay.
We also did a study in the sales context, and basically in we differentiated shops that had in their leadership. And overall, because it was a difficult time at that moment, the sales went down, mm-hmm. but the sales went far less down in those shops that had a servant leadership as their shop manager, for okay. example. That was an example. We see it also at CEO level. There are different studies there that companies that have a CEO who's more of a servant leader, more the characteristics that the companies that have that also have better financial results.
Okay.
And there are some meta-analysis actually, so a meta-analysis where yeah. you combine different studies,
yep.
comparing servant leadership with the other leadership theories that yep. we out there, so yep. transformational, authentic, ethical leadership, and that shows that servant leadership has the strongest effect to not only sort of the soft measures like yeah. engagement, but also to the what harder, more objective measures in terms of performance. So there is already a lot of evidence out there that yeah. shows that it works.
Yeah.
And I think you had an earlier question that I don't think I fully answered. It
okay.
was like, when do you see like that servant leadership became more mainstream and academia?
Oh, yeah.
And I realize I never answered that because what I left out at that moment was that when between 2000 and 2010, all of us were developing measures, that because of these measures, people started to do a lot of research. So mm-hmm. we started to publish mm-hmm. on it. And a lot of the research that I'm just mentioning about that it works, basically a short
yeah.
answer,
yeah.
Started to influence. So we're seeing that at first, we had a lot of problems getting it into top journals, but certain moment that became more easy to do. And also, if I may promote my own work, I do have a 2011 article that played a role there mm-hmm. because it just happened to be the right article in the right time in the mm-hmm. right journal. But what I did in that article, I basically brought everything together. I wrote it to make a bridge between the more practically
yeah.
focused servant leadership literature that was out there, the measures that we had, and to see like, okay, what is the core of what we know now and where do we need to move yeah. into?
Yeah.
And what I've seen that this, because it was a good journal, I got it published in, that then people started to say like, hey, wait a minute, it works. And then it got taken up much more
yeah.
because we had great measures from different people all over the world. We had one or two great reviews, and then it started to feel more than just like a fluffy kind of something that a consultant had written. It became something yeah. that was academically valid
yeah.
and evidence-based.
Ah, so that means that you were also already, I guess, committed to pursuing this avenue of research before it was popular in academic circles, because you said you struggled to get it published.
Yes.
That makes me curious why you would pick that instead of something that would be an easier path to publication. What's your story? What caused you to latch onto this?
Well, I once listened to a famous professor says, if you want to make a career, you have to pick something that nobody is yet doing, that you are passionate about, but that you can see that you contribute a lot to. And that is what servant leadership also had. Because when I was reading the material, somebody gave it to me. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, this way of looking at the world, this way of looking at leadership resonate with my values. And then I looked into the literature and I said, there's nothing out there. And that's perfect, because it means that not only does it resonate with my values and what I would like to see, but also there is a lot of room to do something, to really make a difference, to contribute. And that's something that we want. So having that combination made me to go there and also, you know, link to people that were practitioners in the Netherlands, but also worldwide, and to build networks and start studying it.
Okay. Okay, thank you. So clever choice to some extent, and a little bit of luck.
Yeah, a little bit of luck.
And also a lot of passion to stick with it.
Yes, yeah. And the other one, maybe we talked a lot about empowerment.
Yeah.
Another key element of servant leadership is a sense of humility. And I need to mention it because it is important, because because it has a lot to do with your basic attitude, right? That you are willing to learn, that you know that you're not perfect, that you're willing to step back to let others shine. All these kind of elements are also very important element of people in leadership positions, that we say, hey, that's our servant leaders. We see a sense of humility in them. And that's also where you talk about the challenge. Therein lies a lot of the challenge, because I think if we would think about servant leadership just as empowerment, a lot of people say, oh, I'm doing this.
Yeah.
But then if you say, but okay, but do you also do it from a sense of humility? Are you able to do that? I think there is more hesitation there, at least there should be, because that's much more difficult. Yeah. Because you do not become in that position without really being good and knowing that you have a good ego and knowing to have the results. You basically need that to go there.
Yeah.
And now you're saying you need to be humble? That's a challenge.
Yes, I recognize what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's the very thing that basically we're asking them to let go of the very thing that's given them legitimacy.
Yes.
All along.
Yeah.
And that's a big ask.
And what is interesting, we did actually research to show how important humility is. And you see exactly that. It's less important in the beginning levels if you rise. Because if you're there too, you're humble, you're not visible.
Yes.
So you need to be visible. But the moment you get at a certain level, it becomes very important. So you need to, as you say, you need to basically let go of something that was made you successful in the first place. Difficult. That's a challenge.
And that explains to me also why it doesn't matter what you think about your servant leadership, because...
And it is especially that element when I'm saying there's a low correlation that has a lot to do, but that you do not know how humble you come across.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So humility is a key.
It's for me a very key element, also differentiating it to other leadership theories out there.
Yeah.
Although there is a stream that's actually specifically targeted on humble leadership.
Oh, so, okay.
But that actually feeds a lot of, and the insights there, they'll relate, or they're very much the same as for servant leadership as a whole. So
Okay, so you just created a bit of a, shall I say, a nuance around context. We say early career, it's probably not so helpful because you can be overlooked. Mm-hmm. Later career becomes more important. Mm-hmm. And that triggers another question. Are there certain industries, certain types of organizations? For example, what I'm thinking of a university context or a hospital where you have highly trained, highly autonomous professionals who typically, we hope, of course, are fully committed to their work.
Yes.
They don't need to be managed. I can imagine that in a context like that, servant leadership would be much more effective than one where you're dealing with people who have challenges staying employed, who maybe are not don't have a lot of knowledge or skill and need a lot of that, need a lot of direction. Let me put it that way. Is there any evidence for sort of contextual clues as to when servant leadership would be more appropriate than another?
Actually, it works in a lot of different contexts.
Okay.
And that's the interesting way. So it's been studied in a lot of different organizations, also in the organizations from what you're saying, that okay, they need more direction. It is interesting, the moment you start to treat people with respect and with the value they have, they actually appreciate that. So it's not about the education. It's not about how autonomous you are for yourself. It's more about treating people with a sense of respect and trusting them. And then, of course, knowing how much they can by themselves or not. Because I would agree, you know, professionals, they know that job. You don't go and say to a doctor, you need to do so and so. I mean, you don't, that's not something you interfere with.
Exactly.
But what is important is to create conditions in which this doctor can do the best he can do or she can do when dealing with the patients.
So then it sounds like what you're saying, and I'm saying this to check if I'm getting this, you can be really directive and still be a servant leader if it comes from the place of what is it that they need right now.
I would not go that far.
Okay,
that's going too far. No, okay. It's not saying that it's really directive. What I'm saying is that when it comes to being directive, it's actually, it's a different, so you are directive, but you're directive in a different way. So the term that you then see is it's more about persuasion. Ah. So it's less about telling, but more about, and to find a direction together. So you're saying like, okay, this is what we need to do. That also means you need to create transparency to people. And you say that this is what we are going to do. This is the challenges that we have. And you need time to discuss that. Now, I know that time is not always there. Sometimes you just need to make a decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's why you have that position. But if you can, and you can get people on board and tell them, be transparent about things, see what their ideas are, you probably get a better idea or more commitment for the long run. So when I say about providing direction, it's more, it's actually maybe the wrong term, because it's a lot about providing the conditions in which direction is being sort of found almost together.
Yeah.
So it's really also about getting the team and the organization to feel like, hey, what is it that we are? What is it the direction we want to go to? And then going in that direction. Yeah. And if you are very convinced of something, then you're using persuasion. So not telling, but persuasion to see if people will go along with you.
Yeah. Okay. So, and what I'm also hearing coming through is, And directive was too strong of a word, because directive is, of course, associated with exercising your formal authority.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm telling you this because I'm in this position in the organization. Yes. And what I'm hearing you say is,
no,
that's where we draw the line. You can be persuasive. You can be strong in your arguments. Mm. But as soon as you lean on your formal authority to sway people, then you're no longer, you know, a servant leader. But if you engage with them from the perspective of they have a voice, regardless of where they are in the organization, they have value and they have a voice.
Yes.
And they have a choice.
Yes.
Then there's still plenty of palette available to work with in terms of your influencing. But that all then is potentially still servant leadership.
Is that fair to say? And why it's important is that none of us knows everything.
Yeah.
And I think that if we look at the world at the moment, there's so much things is changing, and it's changing so quickly, and things are connected, that you probably most likely overlook some things.
Yeah.
So if you just say like, this is what we need to do, you may end up doing something that's not perfect. Well, as if you have that conversation and people may come with ideas that you haven't thought about, but maybe perfect from what you feel is important. So it is also important to differentiate the issue at hand and the solution that you have for that issue.
Okay, what do you mean?
Now, a lot of us have the tendency to say like, oh, this is the problem, and I have a solution. Ah. And then we present the solution, and then when people start to argue with the solution, you get into a fight.
Yeah.
And then the way to get around it, I'm saying, well, let's first talk about the issue. What is happening? What do we need to do? What do we need to look at? And if we agree on the issue, only then we start to look at, okay, what can we do about that? And if you do that jointly with a larger team, with more input, then they may, when they understand the issue, they may actually come at solutions that you haven't thought about yourself. And that's also the reason why I'm reacting to your being directive, because you go too fast a lot of times.
Yeah,
you need to step back.
And you're definitely not humble when you're being directive, right?
Probably not.
That's it's unlikely. No. I can't imagine someone doing that out of humility. Yeah. It's probably out of impatience or something, but it's that's different.
Yes.
So this is really about collaborative problem solving,
yes.
building coalitions, yes. stakeholder management, and allowing the time when possible for that sort of buy-in to grow naturally.
Yes.
Okay, got it. Is there any evidence that of cultural fit, for example? I mean, obviously, it came from the U.S. as probably mm-hmm. a correction to some extent to the prevailing mm-hmm. you know, way of thinking about leadership, but it's very Western in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine that in places like, I don't know, Hong Kong, Singapore, Vietnam, you know, where there's different power distance, different ways that people interact. I'm just curious if there's any evidence of its validity in different cultures.
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, it works all over.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really universal. I know it seems too good to be true. But the country that currently produces most research on servant leadership is actually China.
Oh.
It's amazing the amount of studies that come out of that country.
Huh.
And a lot of that is because in its values, it resonates with sort of like a Confucian way of how leadership should be, because the Confucian way is about taking care of the people around you and being responsible for that.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of resonance there. And what is interesting that if you look at studies in Anglo-Saxon versus China, that is that it's more the same than it would be different.
Huh.
So because but you have to see into that the actual behavior is probably a little bit different because it's a different culture.
Yeah.
And timing may be different, and certain element of servant leadership will probably be more important than others. But if you look at to what extent it influences like engagement or commitment or all the other stuff, it's actually quite similar. So the studies that are being done in the US, you can teach from the relationship perspective for Chinese companies, but also vice versa, which is a good thing because nowadays, maybe half or something, a lot of the studies that are coming out there have been studied in the Chinese companies in China, in Chinese.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So we have really a pretty good body of evidence that of its effectiveness across all kinds of contexts, cultural and business and
industry. And also like India or Africa, so all kinds of countries in Europe. So we did that too. So yeah.
So I imagine maybe there's a listener out there who's thinking, "Hey, I had never heard of that, but this is cool. I like this."
Mm-hmm.
Where would they get started? Of course, other than taking a course with you at RSM, but what would your recommendation be for the first thing to start looking at or to start working on?
Mm. Yeah. Go to one of those booksellers online and just type in servant leadership and see which is the one that come up, because there are some short pockets out there, some of them written like 10, 20, 30 years ago, but that shouldn't stop you.
Mm-hmm.
And they are very written from a practical perspective because the ones that wrote it, and yeah, I know some of it is like 20 years old, but they're still very valid and they're understandable because what they are doing is they translate it directly to the business context. And none of them has the full story, in my opinion, but they are very helpful.
Yeah.
And there are different out there. And I don't want to highlight one or the other, but if you just see that, you will see the most one is probably the ones that are useful.
Yeah.
I do know that Greenlee's booklet itself is, you can buy it. You can probably find it online.
Mm-hmm.
Would not be surprised because it's been around so long.
Yeah.
So that would be something. What can you do? Go to YouTube, you know.
Of course,
because that's a resource, and
there
are people who talk about that.
Yeah,
this all kinds of stuff.
And the reason I'm asking is it almost sounds good. Too often we tend to frame leadership as a sort of core competency or skill set, and I've used that word in our interview as well.
Yes,
but it sounds like that's not what it is. It sounds like it's like a baseline attitude, or maybe a worldview. It's a way of looking.
Yes,
way of looking at people, a way of framing your performance challenge that then drives the choices you will make.
Yes, that's true.
Okay.
Yeah, and that is also the difference. So you know, people come to me and they say, like, then you give me a recipe, you know,
yeah,
so
exactly.
A cookbook.
Yes.
If I do AI, B, C, then I will be there. And I'm like, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
It's not, companies that work with it, it took them years to make it part of their company culture.
Yeah.
Because you also need the right people on board. It's a way of working.
Yeah.
We are now bringing out a case which shows servant leadership in an IT company in Norway. And but the beauty of that company was when they started it, they started with saying, this is the values that we want to do. So they, from the beginning, and there were, I think, four of them, mm-hmm. they said, and so they built it on these values.
Yeah.
And when they had like 50 or 60 people, somebody from business school came in and says, like, what you're doing is servant leadership. And then they realized that that's true. And but that is the almost like the easy things because you start from scratch.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you have an ongoing organization, it's more difficult because you may lose people, you may have to adjust the HR system. It's a lot of things that need to be done before you can go there. So it's a longer process, but it is a way of thinking.
Have you ever seen it fail? Fail is
a
strong word.
What we have seen, that's, I want to go back to these companies, but there were some companies that work with servant leadership and they went into a crisis mode. And by going into the crisis mode, they also went more into the directive way of working.
Yeah.
Because some things need to be done. And one of my next research projects for this summer is actually going back to exactly those companies and say, like, hey, what happened? Because the crisis was like 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm really curious to what extent how they got back to the servant leadership mode in that sense.
Yeah.
So again, it's not always the same. And sometimes you need it. And the challenge, of course, then is, can you step back? Can you bring it back again after the crisis has passed?
Yeah.
But even there, there was one company we interviewed them while in the crisis already. And what you see is that employees were much more willing to also work with them.
Mm.
So because of the goodwill that had been built before, there was also that they were sort of saying, okay, we probably need to, you know, maybe earn a little bit less or work a little bit more or do a bit more here. So there was a lot about understanding that that was a difficult period.
Yeah.
In there. So that's also why servant leadership then helps in that sense.
Yeah, almost as an inoculation against that. But are you also then suggesting, or does this suggest that in times of crisis, servant leadership may not be the best direction to default to?
Well, I see in those companies that they go back to more like making decisions quickly because of the need to make decisions quicker.
Exactly.
And then you cannot go through all the processes of talking with everybody, getting whole work groups. I mean, that's not how it works, and you're bankrupt.
Exactly.
So then you need to do it differently.
Yeah.
But what you can do, of course, is say, like, okay, this is a small group, you make the decisions. And if you have the right people, then they can make the decisions. But then a lot of the other things that I'm talking about is more shared kind of way and decision-making, persuasion, that may not always be the time for.
Yeah.
But if you have the right people to do that, they will give it back because they will see it's a temporary thing to guide an organization to that crisis to come back to the way of working that you prefer. That's the other thing. And maybe if I may, because we're talking about servant leadership and I realize that there is one thing that I forgot to mention, and that's what we call stewardship.
Mm.
Because also in academic literature, we have a tendency to give a lot of emphasis on the personal people aspect.
Yeah.
And it's very important. But even going back to Greenleaf, it's also the responsibility that a company has in society. And that's where the stewardship comes in. So. Mm. Top management teams that want to, work with servant leadership, that means also they have to work with the idea, hey, how can I make sure that there is an earth, there is a world out there for my children and the children behind my children, you know? So to really have that, to know that what you have here, you have it in trust for the next generation. And that also is a very much an important element of servant leadership, especially if you go to higher levels in an organization. And it's already there in Greenleaf writings, but it's not always that visible or emphasized in a lot of the recent way of looking at it.
So it sounds like it's really a recognition of the different interests, different responsibilities, and sometimes apparently conflicting responsibilities that you have to meet as somebody in a leadership position. And we so it sounds like it would also be incompatible with the agency theory or the shareholder capitalist. You know, the shareholder is the only thing that's the only person or entity that I owe anything to. That's incompatible fundamentally with servant leadership.
Yes, because you have much more a stakeholder perspective.
Yeah.
And you want to look at all the stakeholders and see how you can bring that together.
Exactly.
Which is much more difficult.
It is. And so then to say, forget about you, Mr. Shareholder. My responsibility is with my employees. You're making the same mistake. Right, because then you're focusing only on your employees, for example, or only on the customer, or only
doesn't work either.
That doesn't. It's about the multiplicity of responsibilities and demands.
Yes,
got it. Thank you. That's very clear. I have one question that's been bouncing around in my head, and maybe we have time for a second. But the question I'd really like to get in is, if you had an opportunity to have a conversation with Robert Greenleaf himself. What would you like to tell him or ask him?
Wow, I don't know. Nobody has ever asked me this question. So maybe I would, you know, I would love to see or hear if he looks at the world nowadays, what he makes of it, and whether he feels that we made any progress in the 50 years plus that since he wrote it. So that would be something I would be very much interested in and to learn from him. And for the rest, I think it would be an interesting conversation because if you read his writings, then you know that this was a very wise man. He really understood people. He knew where people were coming from. If you hear the stories of people who met him in that sense, he was also a very good listener. And knowing where you were and giving you some tips about that. So I wouldn't be surprised that if I would meet him now, that he will actually get me to talk and to ask him questions and guide me to see like, hey, this is Derek, this is what you can do now. This is what I would suggest you do now.
Okay. Derek, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed this interview.
Well, thank you so much.